Welcome to event 85 of the 21st Ledbury Poetry Festival to celebrate the wonderful poetry salon Stablemates. Just over a year ago, Jill Abraham founded Stablemates Poetry Salon, in which three poets from the same publisher get together to read some of their poems in London on the last Thursday of every month. We have Jill Abraham first. That's you. Nick McCoa. He's not. There we go.
Come on, Nick.
Seni Sinibaratne. And Roger Robinson. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Leslie, and thanks to you all for coming. I believe that there are some past and future stablemates in the audience as well. I can see Kaya Chingonyi. He was May, I think, to help celebrate the launch of his book. And Ms. Malaika Booker is out there. She is going to be one of the next stablemates in London on National Poetry Day, the 28th of September. So put it in your diaries and come and see us. I can't see who else is out there, so if I've forgotten anybody, forgive me. So the format of Stablemates is that I don't give you the bio that you've already read about the poets that's brought you here. I interview each of the poets and then they'll read for about 15 minutes. And we're going to start off by just easing you into listening to some poetry by reading a couple of my own. So People Tree Press, who these three are all published by, is based in Leeds and specialises in Caribbean, Black British and South Asian poetry. So I don't really write much about that myself, but I do have a couple of poems that are kind of set in the Caribbean and they're connected. And the first one is called Island Boy. He sets out every day in an outboarded skiff, hoping for barracuda. But the new landowner wants a fee for accessing the beach to deter him from disturbing the dreams of the rich tourists. He sells his catch and goes home, air-conditioned by open windows and island breezes, tanks up on rum before hitting the bars to flatter white women in hope of an invitation overseas, a green card. He doesn't say much. He has learned to listen. He's a good dancer, wears his shirt loose and open, knows his six-pack abs are good bait. He is skilled at luring and holding attention, hasn't yet reeled one in. He gives away smiles, compliments, massages, and his email address, investing his charm and looks for a return of a flushing toilet, consistent electricity, soft-hand employment, and a computer of his own. So I read that to somebody and they said, well, I quite like it, but I think you need to write the other point of view or, you know, a kind of counter poem. And at the time I was doing Mimi Calvati's versification class and every week she taught us a form, a new form of poetry. But didn't give her, you know, she teaches and then you'd have to go away and write a poem and there was no kind of subject prompt. So it was Villanelle week and I thought, well, I'll make my counter poem into a Villanelle. Island tourist. I think it's time I took a holiday. The Caribbean's where I want to go. I should escape to somewhere far away. I've saved up all my overtime to pay for 2 weeks all-inclusive in Tobago. I can't afford to take a holiday. I'll lie on silver sands at Baku Bay, embraced by my own local gigolo. I should escape to somewhere far away. I'll buy him gifts. He'll let me have my way. My husband never puts me first, and so it's really time I took this holiday. We'll both pretend it's pure so we can say, I love you, plan our futures, but we'll know it's just escaping somewhere far away. I'll fly back home alone, though I dare say he'll hope to come along with me, but no, I'll only take him for the holiday. Not his escape to somewhere far away. Thank you. So the first poet I'm going to introduce is Roger Robinson. So, Roger has just come back from Finland. What were you doing there?
I was at a conference called Afro-Europe's, where I was attending talks, and in the evening, I was the entertainment. So I read poems and I did a music set on two separate evenings out there. But one of the interesting things being out there, you get to hear a lot of really esteemed lecturers from around the world talk about different topics and really, really, really up to the latest, you know, of it. And whilst I was out there, I did a lot of thinking and about directions and stuff.
What conclusions did you come to, were you thinking?
Ooh, I think my writing is going to go in the direction of creative citizenship. Like really exploring, let me turn a little more this way, like I'm talking to Jill. Really exploring what it is to be a citizen in the UK, Europe, and the world, but in a kind of creative way. And so I was kind of going that direction in a little bit, but when I got out there and I heard some talks, I was like, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to do this. There was a talk by somebody called Johnny Pitts, Afropeans, and it struck me that we were doing a similar thing, except he was kind of further ahead. So I'm looking to do something like that in poetry. But I've been writing poems for my new and selected, and the direction before that was really looking at nature and how nature could kind of reflect a kind of ongoing Caribbean identity. So I think I'm set for the next couple of years.
Brilliant. And you've done a lot of music as well, so tell us a little bit about that. You just mentioned you were doing
this. Is like Roger's CV day. And then what I did was, so the music is, I write songs, mostly electronic songs with different bands and tour with them. But recently, in my own solo work, I've been doing dub poetry, trying to extend stuff that Linton Kwesi Johnson and Benjamin Zephaniah did as a kind of living tradition, and trying to continue it on. You know, so and that's been going pretty well. I enjoy it. So I like running several things parallel, and the dub poetry works for me because you can put music and poems together.
Brilliant. Well, let's hear some poems.
I talked a little bit just now about creative citizenship. This poem, I'm sure by now you all know about the Grenfell disaster, and it really affected me, so I wrote a poem about it. And this is the kind of example that, you know, what creative citizenship is for me and how it's affecting my writing. Yeah. The missing. As if their bodies became lighter. 10 of those seated in front pews began to float and then to lie down as if on a bed, then down the aisle as if on a conveyor belt of pure air, slow as a funeral cortege, past the congregation, some sinking to their knees in prayer, one woman rocking back and forth, muttering, "What about me, Lord? Why not me?" The risen streaming slowly, so slowly, out the Gothic doors and up into the sky. Finches darting deftly between them. 10 streets away, a husband tries to hold on to the feet of his floating wife. And at times her force lifts him slightly off the ground, his grip slipping and falling to his knees with just her high heel shoes in one hand as she is backlit by the sun. He shields and squints his eyes. 200 people start floating from the windows of a tower block. From far enough away, there could be black smoke from spreading flames. A father with his child on top his shoulders, men in sand-colored galabeers, a woman with an Elvis quiff and vintage glasses, a deep indigo hijab flapping in the wind, an artist in a wax cloth head wrap, all suddenly airborne. Slowly, so slowly, these superheroes of faith rising, this airborne pageantry, this shoal of believers, was it belief that made them rise? For many believers, I amongst them, are looking up. Or is it about purity of the soul? the purest soul not being easily soiled, but the stain on the impure soul being a palimpsest of sin cleansed by confession, followed by more sin. Amongst the cirrus clouds floating like hair in the sky, they began to look like a separate city. Someone looking on could mistake them for new arrivals to earth, like human lantern wishes. They are the city of the missing, and we now the city of the stayed. Sometimes I forget when I go to poetry festivals, everybody's really quiet. I was like, oh my God, they hated that poem. But then I realized, it's good though, it's good. I like it, new styles. I'm going to read another poem about creative citizenship. I know it. So, I walk through Brixton with a young man in screw-faced street mode. His temptations course through his blood. I tell him it's okay to relax. He calls me witness. He calls me bookish. He calls me mentor. We walk avoiding certain streets, Loughborough, the railway. We both know why. I tell him that beneath these very streets we walk, deep beneath the concrete, beneath the tarmac, beneath the rubble, beneath the rock, a river flows. A dark and powerful river coursing without light, that 150 years ago, royalty would sail into Brixton in their best finery. Never thinking about crack, never thinking about cafes, never thinking about tower blocks, never thinking about screw face. But every now and then, these tower blocks act like speakers. And the sound of pure flowing water can be held throughout the streets of Brixton. Even though the river calls, things have moved on here. Brixton is not its history, and neither should we be. Even though we hear the call of our past, we all need room for change. What else should I read? I will read. It's on my phone, I apologize. It's super fresh, trust me. It's not in a book anyway. Like having it on your phone is the equivalent of like wet ink. I guess so.
Well, I'm just looking for that. Roger tweets regularly, tweets for artists, and they're absolutely fascinating. So follow Roger on Twitter. R. Robinson's
72. Our Robinson 72. Thank you for that. I found it. I'm originally from Trinidad. So I'm writing a series of poems as if Trinidad is a paradise. And all the animals in this paradise begin to speak. Sounds crazy, but it works. So Leatherback Turtle speaks. After Major Jackson. I am ancient. I have ridden this planet's tides for centuries. These seas are full of my brethren. My memory is manifold. My shell an ode to protection. I read the stars like an ancient book of maps. To this specific beach as we've been for hundreds of years, I am ancient. I pass memories and maps through my genes. My sons and daughters will experience my knowledge as instinct and deja vu. I am known by all sea beasts as peaceful, so I am not hunted. It is my karma. I am ancient. In water I am speed, but out I am a meditation. I am playing the long game of thought, consistency, actions, and generations. Where else would my lineage through time return to this beach at this time where our great-great-grandfathers were born? I am ancient. You stare at me while I birth my eggs, but I remember you when your father brought you here to see me as a child. With thick plaits and red ribbons, and I remember you when you are gray and in your glasses. Just because I'm slow, you think I am stupid. Just because I move slowly, you think I am lazy. You think yourself superior in your speed. I am ancient. Slow belies a purpose. I want to savor everything. I want each thing to be done well without distraction. I am ancient. I don't want to cram more and more into this life. I have a purpose. And you may be looking on, but I am not here about you. I have this job to do at a meditative pace. And you learn something about taking time and bringing forth new generations and savoring every second of your purpose. You've gathered here to watch something ancient without ever stopping to think that something ancient may be watching you. This is something about dolphins, just to change the pace. This is after Simon Armitage. Trinidad dolphins. We secretly hate humans. We only swim and dance beside them to keep up the image of the tourist board. We swim and dance, and they give us buckets of chopped up fish. A simple arrangement. They check their reports to see how many tricks we did, if we smiled, if we went backwards on our tails while smiling. Do that one, and you get 5 bucket fish bonus. But that don't mean I like them. I like the simplicity of the arrangement. One time they wanted to hold a meeting with us. The tourist board love a meeting. But we just tell them dolphins don't like no meetings. Keep it simple. Tourists, tricks, and run the fish. The only thing we like less than humans are sharks. They think they're so bad with their rows of teeth and slits for eyes. We just bounce them with our bottlenose in their ribs and mash them up just for jokes. Like sharks could ever be badder than dolphins. So the humans now think we're protecting them when they're diving because we're mashing up them sharks. Because it's always about humans, right? But not so. A shark could chomp on a diver's leg for all we care. We just really, really hate sharks. And we don't want none of them around we. That is such a stupid poem. Like, even when I wrote, I like, this is so stupid. Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if that will make the book, but I enjoyed it when I did it, you know? This, I'm also, in the extension of the idea of paradise, Trinidad is an extremely religious, conservative country. And that's what I grew up under. And to some extent, I've been trying to kind of recontextualize things that I've always heard about. So this is this poem is about Jonah, because I extended the idea of just writing about animals in paradise in Trinidad to the idea of belief. So I have a few poems that are just articulations on belief. This is Jonah, after Douglas Woodson. Everybody know Jonah and the whale, yeah? Yeah? Okay. So something, you never know. Please get me out of this whale, dear Lord, and back to my family who await me anxiously. This whale can feel me sitting in his bowels, ruminating on escape. Perhaps he mistakes me for a whaler or one who has done his family harm. One gulp of the sea would drown me and I would be too tired to fight against rising water. My head is bleeding. It's so dark and damp in here. I can only focus on my thoughts of my family. What sudden calamity has led me here? Satan. Yes, Satan is trying to make me into whale food, keeping me swallowed yet alive in this briny pit of this whale's stomach. I can't even sleep for entrail rumblings and whale songs so loud, Lord. I have cried. I have cursed you. I have questioned your judgment. But I know that if you wanted to, you would smite me with one flick of his flute or a well-placed tooth. Now I am covered with blood and sea, but I am miraculously alive. So there must be some bigger plan that you have for me, so I must not lose faith. So now I'm praying, prayers of worship, of intercession, of commitment, of consecration and dedication. Dear Lord, comfort my family till you deliver me to them once more. Till then, I am your humble servant. Amen. This is back to kind of creative citizenship again. It's called a night shift. With the stars scattered in the sky like dust in a dim light, I'm on the N109 bus amongst the bubbling gossip and smell of strong thermos coffee. These Nigerian women are not in bed at 3 a.m. They're on their way to clean the West End buildings of the rich with nothing but dry bread in their brown paper bags. Their last shift ended 3 hours ago, so one of them is nodding off, only to be woken each time by their raucous laughter. On the streets, ravers are heading home with smudged mascara and damp hair, and two worlds momentarily cross paths. These Nigerian women, when they get to their buildings, they will unwrap their head ties and fold away their Dutch print wraps for a pale blue apron and a pink plastic hair protector, a bucket, a mop, and a chamois cloth. Look up in any building at night, and you will see their silhouette wiping away the dust of yesterday's bankers. Suspended in the air between heaven and earth, their silhouettes are choreographed every night. Back bent and stretched and wiped, and backs bent, stretched and wiped, suds bubbling in steaming water, toilet after toilet after toilet, and aching backs and swollen knuckles and aching wrists mopping away their own footsteps. But there are small children waiting on meager wages for gari, school shoes, and books in Lagos. So they must dance this dance with these hoovers in office ballrooms from morning till midnight. But for now, in the dim light of the N109, they are laughing with their rumbling stomachs lined with bread and teasing the one who is nodding off. And the stars are scattered in the sky above the bus like dust. Thank you.
So the next poet I'm going to introduce is Seni Senavratne, and this is her book, The Heart of It, which I'm really enjoying reading at the moment. I'm ashamed to say that I haven't got to the end of it before presenting this, but it's really wonderful. And Seni, one of the other things that I know about you is that you've worked a lot with people who've suffered trauma, and you've worked kind of as a therapist as well as using poetry to help them. So perhaps you'd like to tell us something about that.
Yeah. When I worked as a therapist, which I don't do anymore, I worked a lot with, particularly with women who'd experienced trauma and abuse and with refugees. And coming out of that work, because it's the kind of work that you can only do really for a certain amount of time, I think, and do well, I got a fellowship to do some work looking at poetry and trauma and the relationship between them, which sort of became a paper that I delivered in various places. So I started to sort of, it was like putting the two parts of what I do together, really. And it was very exciting, and it's going to be an article soon. And I said it here, you see, it's going to be written up properly as an article. At the moment, it's a paper that I've presented at various conferences. So, watch this space for that.
Oh, that sounds really exciting. And has that fed into some collaborative work that you've been doing?
Well, I think what happens when you do work like that is it kind of influences what you do. I never write about the work and never write about work I've done with particular people, but what happens is it influences what you want to write about. So recently, all of last year, I was working with a digital artist, and we did a big project that was really about power and violence against women, and it was based on the story that's told in Ovid's Metamorphoses about Philomela, who's turned into a nightingale, and it became a major performance thing that we did, which was telling her story, but through her telling the story of violence and abuse. And I'll probably read one or two things from that. Great. You know,
and this book is a few years old now, so have you got another one in the pipeline?
Yes. I'm currently working on a book that's based on my father's experiences in the Second World War. He was he fought in the British Army as a signaller in North Africa. And I've got a series of photographs of his. And I've been very interested in working out, because he died when I was quite young, so I never really asked him about these photographs enough. So I'm interested in the man who took the photos. And so I've begun to write something in this man's voice, who I've never met, and the way he saw my father. And alongside that, poetry that I've written about my father. And I'll probably read some of the poems, because the longer prose pieces are a bit too long for this session, yeah.
Well, let's hear some poems.
Well, thank you, everybody, for turning up today, and thanks to Ledbury, thanks to Jill for inviting me, thanks to these guys, it's so great to see them, and all the rest of the Complete Works people that I worked with some years ago, and to Mimi Kulvati, who mentored me and helped me become the poet that I want to be. I'm going to start with my favourite poem from this book. A young woman was fished out of the River Seine in the 1800s, and nobody knew who she was, but the assumption was that she'd probably committed suicide, and I decided to write a poem in her voice. L'inconnu de la Seine. There was a swell on the surface of the Seine that day, making faces at me. So I blew kisses at an open mouth and whispered, drown me peaceful, drown me slow. I wanted the time, you see, to float undead through Paris. I could have choked on a glass of milk as a child and missed this opportunity. Don't call it suicide as if it's a tragedy. This was the first time in my life I had been in control of anything. Imagine, not dying, but dissolving, becoming a river. Was I afraid? Not of the fall. I was afraid of the water police. The way they walk along the river, any one of them could have seen me floating. But nightfall saved me. Before the river had me, I had one last look at the stars. Just look at you, I said, already dead. And still shining. Some of this book is kind of in two halves, and that sort of straddles between the two. And the first half of it is largely about a personal heartbreak. And I'm going to read the one poem, which is really when I'd got to that place where I was kind of coming out of it and, a little bit wiser about the experience, and it's called In Which I Repair to Rome. Next time Venus calls, I'll put her on hold. In the meantime, I've come to Rome with Ovid and his metamorphoses. In the space between trains, even destinations can change. In the Villa Borghese, under a cedar of Lebanon, I hear a woman tell her husband she can't cope. She digs into her canvas bag for eye drops, squeezes them, tears going in the wrong direction. A poodle passes and seems to lift her spirits the way dogs do for some people. She sighs. There are boats sailing at the hem of her skirt on a rose-pink river. In her heyday, she probably learned the Louvre from end to end. Now it's all she can do to flick through a rough guide to Rome. Sometimes I think I'll never be well again, she says, and worries her fingers against the metal fretwork. There can be no stories of unchanging bliss. Love is an ice cream, and if on some coastlines the sea collides and swells with a river, it doesn't mean they will grow old together. Now, Roger says it's time for me to not be doing heartbreak poems, and I have to be doing love poems. And, given that I have now met somebody who I want to grow old with. This is a poem for her. It's called Remember. Remember that first walk in the woods, fallen leaves underfoot, turning to mulch on a muddy path, where I found a berry, hawthorn, you said. And if the shell of an acorn was the berry's boat, the oak leaf was its ocean, all of which became my offerings, left by the archway of a curved branch, before bending to see the face of a woman carved by the movement of rock against itself, her brow leaning against stone, her gaze fixed on an elephant dancing under a bright fern which had sprouted against all odds from a cleft in the rock. Remember the broken tree by the pond, where you traced the flight of a kingfisher you once saw, and how I followed the arc of its blue as if I could see it in your memory. That one just popped in there because I had a really neat kind of link between repairing to Rome and the next one, which is to talk about the collaboration I did, which was based on one of Ovid's tales, which is the one about Philomela. And I'm going to assume that people know about it and know the story, and if not, that you'll look it up. But I wanted to write... She's been written about, this woman, by everybody else, but never really spoken in her own words. So part of the piece that we did, she actually spoke a lot in her own words. And this is one piece in four parts where she's expressing the trauma of what happened to her. She was raped by her brother-in-law and left in the forest. Philomela, in her own words. Night after night, his hollow bones stalk my dreams like a death mask. He's all talk, all promises and bunches of dead roses, telling me I can trust him like family. But I can never remember why I shouldn't. He's bloody in the flame's trick of light, but I'm the one in pieces, with no time to run before the candle's snuffed out. 2. I remember that I left, like leaving wounded bodies behind on a battlefield. I was up in the trees, looking down on the battlefield, and it was my body down there, mauled by the enemy, mouth open as if calling and calling, though in my ears there was only a cacophony of birdsong that would not be silenced. 3. Were there signs I should have read, omens I ignored? The trees mock me, their leaves falling like silent tongues turned to mulch on the forest floor. I count for nothing. I see reflections of myself in the cracked mirrors that hide in their bark, replaying my shame. I should have done better, trusted less, run faster. 4. Felled trees are monuments to my demise. Their twisted limbs kick the air as mine did. I was nothing but dead wood, stripped bark, and pinned like his trophy to the forest floor. What use is beauty without respect? What use is kinship without trust? I'd rather be half bird, half woman, than prey to the fangs of wild men. The rain dilutes everything. I am disappearing. Okay, I'm just going to change the tone a little bit. Malaika said the other day that somebody had said to her that she always writes really dark poems, and I do that quite a lot. And I was asked to write a poem for an anthology about the periodic table. And I decided to choose cobalt because I thought, just for a change, I'm going to write a really beautiful poem about painting and the use of cobalt. And I started to do some research about cobalt, and I discovered that it's the main ingredient in the super alloy that's used to make drones, and that there's It's like a conflict mineral, and yeah. Anyway, so I tried. So I decided to write a poem in Cobalt's voice to try and redeem it. I'd rather be known for my blue notes, cool notes, my porcelain pigments, my bohemian heritage. That's not a goblin you see in my mirror. I'm clean, a purer tint than Prussian, the painter's friend, a good substitute for skies where ultramarine fails, ideal for halftones in lights, violet shades in flesh. Don't let the stories you hear tarnish my reputation. Think how Cezanne, Pizarro and Turner lauded me. Look at me in that light, atmospheric, unsubstitutable, essential in any landscape. Did you know, at Lavercourt, Monet made a field of pure snow from me with only hints of white? Renoir relied on me, and as for Van Gogh, his starry night over the Rhone would be nothing without my stable smalt. Credit where it's due. I should thank the colour merchant, Thénard, whose timely intervention widened my horizons from metallic to more artistic pursuits. But these days, I'm a victim of my own moderate malleability. Believe me, it's no choice of mine, this unholy union with nickel. I'd no desire to join an aristocracy of superalloys. I don't care how high they fly, bent as they are on conquering the skies. I was the sky. I am the sky. Remember me for that. What I'm working on at the moment is a piece that's, it's a book about my father's experiences. And I'm in the poetry that I'm doing, it's kind of me trying to look at him and his life and, speak about some things that I haven't spoken about before. So I'm going to read a few of those. See how the time goes. For my father. 1. It was a little like black water, like lonely, like hungry, his boyhood. No wonder he needed something stronger, something not bone-like, though bones are strong, something before calcium, something to pull him away would do, something otherworldly, a watchful eye in the clouds, a hand pulling him towards the old woman she would have been, were it not for, let's say he was a boy and he walked without a mother. 2. Like medicine, the years between, long enough to dull the first cut. Door on door opened and closed, but she was always somewhere else, as if winnowed to oblivion. Perhaps the reordering of squares in the skeletons of crosswords was all he could do. And then again, the meticulous polishing of his children's shoes every Sunday evening was another way of repairing the damage. Where a river meets the sea. I've been searching in the Lackadive Sea for a story, though it's not mine to tell. In any case, it eludes me, too deeply submerged for my held breath, and I'm not made for sea diving. What I need is as fragile as the soft-bodied polyps busy building coral reefs to hide in. I scour the stony skeletons, bone grafting one story with another. It's no good. I want the journey I never had with the old man my father never became. I want to stand at the mouth of the Kaluganga with him and say, so this is the sea, Dad. This is the sea that carried you, motherless, over its horizon, so far removed from monsoons and mangosteens that you learned to live without them. You were a child migrant, not like these days. You had safe passage and a welcome when you arrived. You found love here, taught me to value what's in the cup more than what's been spilled, how to gather summer fruits and preserve their joy through winter. This last one is going to go in that book, and it was written for a book called Women on Brexit, which was launched in the House of Commons couple of weeks ago. It was so exciting to be reading in one of those big, busty old rooms with all these paintings of white old men around the walls, and the most of the people that were in the launch contributing in there as the audience were black women. It was just an amazing experience. My poem was called The Habit of Hope. My brother had a lot... he was diagnosed with cancer in the year that the Brexit vote happened, and the results were on his birthday, so it was like it was really, you know, hard for him, and he had a hard year, so that's kind of referenced a little bit in this poem. The Habit of Hope. Though it's sometimes nurtured by the naming of birds, mine's not a thing with feathers, but more like measured footfall on a slow walk to the hide, the moon a crescent in morning sky, putting one foot in front of another towards the promise of a stillness, which is more like hovering, the way a hummingbird hovers, 50 wing beats per second, savouring moments of colour, collecting nectar in small sips, playing a part in the bigger picture of survival. It is, after all, what I leaned on, this habit, this year, when every month seemed to bring bad news. And I held my breath waiting for results of one kind or another. You see, my dad taught me years ago, even when there's no cure in sight, when the pain has invaded your bones and your legs can't press the clutch, you don't give up. You swap your manual gears for automatic, and you keep on driving. Thank you.
If you were here last night, you'll know that Roger and Nick and I are all members of Malaika's Kitchen, and we've had a lot of reasons to celebrate this year, including Malaika Booker, our founder, and Nick both being nominated for the, or shortlisted for the Forward Prizes this year. And this is Nick's debut collection, and it's been shortlisted for the Felix Dennis Prize for Best First Collection. Also, all three of these poets have been members of the Complete Works programme, which Senny referred to. And that's a programme of mentoring for black and minority ethnic poets to try and raise the level of publication. The scheme was started because there was a report done that of all the poetry books being published in this country, only 1% were by people from that group. And the last report... that figure had gone up to 8%. And the Complete Works is now in its third phase. And these guys were all members of the first phase. And their work was all put into an anthology, 10, which is also available from the foyer outside. So, Nick, you were a member of the Complete Works, and you've also been a fellow of the Cave Carnum project in America. So can you tell us a bit about that and how those two schemes have helped you?
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed, I'm a writer of colour. And because of that report, it affects me. So I want to get my work published. I survive as a writer. I am nothing else. You know, this is not a hobby. This is my passion. It's what I take seriously. It's what I do every day. So those two schemes were a lifeline. The Complete Works came at the right time, and it taught me many things. So one thing all artists must do is improve their craft. I think I became a better writer because I had I think we were a very good cohort. We took each other seriously. We supported each other. We respected everything, every challenge they put in front of us. We ran at it, I think it would be the right term. Would you agree with that, Sunny, Roger? Mm-hmm. Malaika?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was probably, I say this honestly, I was probably the weakest link because I was the least aware. There's also a business side to being a writer, which you're not really made aware of. And because of a lot of the barriers are publishers who really don't understand your work or the context of where you're from, it makes it hard. But what was really gracious is our mentors, they were like these angels that just kind of flew down and said, oh, really? That's really interesting work you're doing. Try this, read that, check this out. And it just gave us all a level of confidence, and they made themselves accessible to us, and there were workshops you could go to, there was Arvon courses you could attend, there, you know. And then we created, well, Natalie, who ran it, she created this thing called a salon where we'd just meet up and share the work that we were developing. So that was the complete works. We were lucky we got 2 years of that. And it was a breeding ground for a lot of the good work that you're probably seeing coming out, and probably why it's in its third cycle. Carve Economy is a similar process. It's a writer's retreat in America for writers of color. It's a three-year process, so you get 1 week over a five-year period, you get to have three of those. I chose to do it back to back to back. It was quite hard because I had to finance my way over there as well, and I'm a father as well, and you know, and a husband. So it was hard negotiating being away every Father's Day because it always ends on Father's Day, you know. So my kids haven't seen me for four Father's Days, but. What that did, I remember my first day there, I burst into tears. And I think what it was is just the awareness that there's way more black writers than I imagined, you know. And because when you walk around what we consider the publishing industry, I mean, there are many times I go to a meeting, I'm the only black face, which is quite awkward. It's quite unsettling, if that makes sense. So I think being able just to look at the work, some of the poems that I want to share with you are written while I was in those processes. And I think it released something. It gave me a space for thinking. Writers need this invisible space where we can take risks. And I think that's what those gave me.
And who was your mentor for Complete Works?
I had George Surtees. He's amazing. I had George Surtees. Yeah. He's a Jedi.
I don't know if you know George. He's born in Hungary and came over here as a child, but still has the strongest Hungarian accent of anybody I've ever heard.
That's how Jedi's talk.
Pardon?
That's how Jedi's talk.
That's how Jedi's talk. That explains it then. Yeah. But his culture, I mean, his culture isn't a kind of a standard British culture, and yours isn't a standard British culture, so that must have been an interesting mix. And your book is full of Africa, Uganda. So how do you find this sort of mix of cultures writing within that?
I mean, I think, in many ways I have to thank George, because what he allowed me to do was to help me investigate my Ugandanness. I know that sounds strange, but if you think of it, it's almost like I'm from a Ugandan, I was born in a Ugandan context, if that makes sense. But I live in a Western British context. And how do I share that Ugandan experience to a Western context without feeling I'm having to translate myself, without feeling that, you know, something is lost? And I think what I learned was from how he learned to express himself, you know, being in this context, but also coming from Hungary, and that was very useful. We used to spend days at a time just talking about the experience. And, well, I didn't talk, I just shut up, which is amazing for me, but and listen to him, you know, so, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Let's hear the poems.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I want to try and go through a few of these. So basically, this poem, this book is called The Kingdom of Gravity. It's based around the Idi Amin regime, which is 1971 to 79. My mom had to, well, we escaped because of that. She kind of had to pull me out. She just pulled me out just before the coup that happened in 1979. So all these poems are written to kind of give you the world of Uganda at that time. So I'm going to share them. I'm going to share with you the title poem at some point, which is The Kingdom of Gravity. And then I'm going to end, hopefully, if the timings are right, on a poem, the last poem that I wrote for the book, which is Bird in Flames. Stone. The best thing I did was move my body from one side of the world to another. Now, this required a visa, which required a bribe. The bribe was placed in the palm of a man with a gun. Took my mother's monthly wage packet. The man with a gun let you speak to a clerk. He, too, wanted his wage because it would be his job to have words with a judge for another month's salary. The official wanted his bribe, so listened to the clerk, escorted by the soldier as he held his gun. I sat with my mother at the steps of the court, drinking soda, waiting for one man to say yes. My mother said, in Uganda, a bribe stops men from doing nothing. It rolls away the stone. Her sits was slower than mine, each separated by this prayer. Self. Don't quote me, but I swear the radio hissed, run for your lives! Anyway, fast forward, and I'm being taken by the hand to Entebbe Airport. Commercial flights cancelled. There's a queue of people with the right faces but wrong surnames and no luggage waiting for a cargo plane to London. People I barely know, but they swear they know me well. Smiles disguise thoughts that if spoken would get us, you know, arrested. And or worse, then somebody shouts, there's space in the front! Under floodlights, we're shuffled in, Noah's Ark style, traveling all night, leaving the sun behind. Only the clouds show their form. When the color of the sky has gone, as the engines purr in a constant exhalation, the future is speeding towards me. A loud darkness leaks through the cabin window. I'm listening to it, not the noise, but the rhythm. This high above the world, in between time, I can't help but wonder, now that I've left our country, who will turn out the lights? In the terminal, my ears are popping. When the immigration officer steps from his desk with my mother's passport in his hand and asks me, just like you did, tell me that story again. King of Myth. Back when you were taken from our life, like the Son of God ascending into heaven at the barricade to another life, policemen on their motorbikes named you King of Myth. You danced to tossed grenades, all part of the charade in their fire ritual. In this restless air, we surrendered our weapons, axe heads, shanks, short rope, blade, some poison, and all its animal understanding. Now fair game to the enemy with our world in their scope. They came down hills during the blackout, phantoms from a fallen sky, with years of practice at soft landings onto roofs in darkness. Like a spirit slipping into skin, the voice of their guns kept the violence from escaping. A disturbance in the trees is easily mistaken for wind. Honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me, as the radio sings. You guys are allowed to move. They're not happy poems, so you can't laugh or giggle, but you're allowed to move. I know it's hot, so. Resurrection Man. Somewhere west of our sacred sites, the ghost of your former self is rising from captivity. Your student friend, the one that saw you last, Swear she left you alive in the taxi, even after my two-fisted punches. She denies being the one who gave the signal for dark men to change their shapes in the night as you knelt blindfolded. I wanted to believe she had no part in the shaving of your hair and pubic mound in front of onlookers, rebels kneading your breasts like posho in their palms, begging in turn for your body, bleached by the Jeep's headlights. Once broken, you were dragged by the arms across the grass onto the unpaved taxiway of Aurora Airport. Then one yelled, "Burn her, the witch." Their echoes agreed. One lit the match. Another peeled the blindfold. The rest poured gin on your face. I know you saw me in the hollow of the tree. I wanted to run to you, but their bullets would have easily caught up with me. I stood firm, learning to hide my face in the dark. A man must have two faces, one he can live with and one he will die with. The second face is mine.
Is that a quiet clap? We're just like, I like that poem. All
right, so I don't know about you guys, but my daughter's read this book, and I trust my daughter. She's only, she's 12, but she's got the brain of like an 18-year-old, but she doesn't know it yet. So, but she's, I asked her to tick the poems that she likes, and this poem I'm going to share with you is one of her favorite poems. It's, once again, it's not an easy poem to read. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, because maybe your imaginations will set fire. So if you can close your eyes, if you can still see me, your eyes are open. Ah, you do laugh. Okay, you know how to do that. Good, good. All right. The dark. You will try to make sense of it, of the terrain, its limits on reality, its secondary sounds, the crickets speaking pure rhetoric. What is the year? No matter. Stripped of remembrance, isn't the dark a grave, an axis which all are measured, the final mountain? Blessed are the dead, whose bodies are buried in the bosom of the earth. Blessed are those who no longer taste fury, who when brought to silence make dust their paper. In these hours of damp, the sky will witness bombs, hollow out our city. Be vigilant. Choose your executioners well. Do not talk of wills. Bless the pavements that will become your burial grounds. For what can we give except our bodies? Those who are your children will make homes in doorways. Cover your heads. Our patriarchs have been ripped off the walls. It is not the dark, but what it leaves behind. A servant girl on her knees has given testimony that the king has been added to our day's dead. Lose respect. Lose ceremony. Lose duty. Lose circumstantial evidence. Lose the code. My father should not have died today. Lose the law, lose remembering, lose absence. In the absence of the law, truth will not be written down. Lose those who break it. Cowards who confess on scratchy radio broadcasts. Field generals and their informers lose epitaphs. I have my father's eyes and his ratchet smile. Mirrors betray me. What anchors me has drifted to the boundary. What a poor murder. He should have died at war. Close combats, an instep to the shoulder, then a knee to the chest, or his crown caught in the scope of a symbol rebel's scope. As the world draws close, not caught off guard as in a drunken brawl over his wife, because this is how the loss of light should come to the world. You can open your eyes. Somebody had a good sleep there, didn't they?
Yeah, it was me.
Oh, that was delicious. All right, so this is the title poem, and to listen to what Jill said, I actually wrote this in at Carvey Con, and we had this, they have a regime where you literally have to write a poem by 10 o'clock the next day, and I don't know about, Malika and I are probably one, maybe three of three writers from England who've been to Carvey Con, and I was suffering severe jet lag. So all the Americans would be okay. They'd party all night, write in the morning. But I would literally have to sleep. And around 4 o'clock in the morning, this is what came out. So I'll share with you one of my poems. This is called the kingdom of gravity. We are not Alexander, who conquered worlds, giving them new tongues, but we share the story of a ship resting on an African river, unbuckling at its shore, awakened by a night's cold, hard rain, staring at the face of the Nile as it reminds you, you are a hawk, caught in the silent voice of a midnight universe. What makes a man name a city after himself? Asking bricks to be bones, asking the wind to breathe like the lungs of a night, asking the night to come closer, to speak to you as a tribe, asking the tribe to sleep, asking sleep to loosen language, asking language to dream. Come close to me. Can you not see that I'm in search of fire? The unshapen song of light? In my mouth is the name, hovering like smoke, spoken to me by the oracle. Like others, I was in search of a forest, a place to call home. But what can I tell you about the kingdom, about having the world at your feet? When you have seen all of Earth's boundary, you will crave for them in mirrors. You will search for them in streams. And when the river looks back at you, how can you be sure that nothing is lost? Oh, you can clap. You want to clap? Yeah. That's my man right there. That's my man right there. Give this man a card. Go on. Send it. Give him a card. You're the one who started it. I'll remember you for life. That's my friend over there. Yeah. The rest of you are just a close second. Yeah? Oh, now you're laughing. Okay, good. All right, so two more. Is that okay, Joe?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, all right. So this one is called Black Death. I wrote this, Roger and I are going to be going on tour later on in the year, but I wrote this to D'Angelo's new album. So I kept listening to it every day. And one of the things I was realizing is with all the things that are going on in the world, the weight of the black body doesn't amount to much. There is no value in the black body, sometimes by ourselves and sometimes by different members of society. So this kind of looks at, particularly in Uganda, the value of the black body. Two men, Black Death, by the way, two men who have never had a country of their own fall out over a girl in a bar. In place of war, they pull off their shirts, lunatics, in an embrace, as a barmaid fills their glass with local aid. Policemen hang out of armed cars with sophisticated weapons. Fleas fry on their backs as a ricochet gives voice to the air. At full stretch, a camera blinks at an unshaven male, clearly dead. They are beating his body while I stand outside myself. A year from now, I will suffer the same fate, death by water. This body will be a map in the dark, moving towards the shore. By the open stove of my wife's village, there'll be death by surprise, death by marriage, death by having rummaged into a past, into a distant past, of a man that neither of us remembers. After the boycott marches, there will be death by placards. In radio silence, Israeli ground troops will storm the home looking for the archbishop. Death by Judas kiss. Lizard-colored helicopters filled with embassy men and snipers with walkie-talkies will signal for death by long shot. Demonstrators behind masks with eyes like loaded dice will ask for death by decay. A body turning black. Bloodlet like a pig. The crowd is here, offering false compliments to an immigrant on his knees. Death by confession. Word that are not their own. A note whispered in earshot of the New York Times news crew as a man sets fire to himself. The body now an animal, bent double, as a shadow of vague form promises to raise itself from the earth. Okay, my last poem
It's called Bird in Flames, and it's basically about a famous archbishop in Uganda. I'll say no more than that. And then I just want to say thank you to all the 40 people in the room, because it's a very hot day out there, and you've given us your time. And thank you for you, my friend, for clapping. Keep it real. Give them a high five when they come out, but you're better than they are, all right? All right. Bird in Flames. A man and his beer talk to another man. After a swig of a dark bottle, his lips leak out a In the first death, I'm a bird, darting from an oncoming pickup truck under starlight as I head for the grass. A static quiet. The pickup drives down the road. Two men mention genocide. A third struggles to confess that he has spoken to the tribes and it stirred a conflict. Earlier, the third man was blindfolded, a hand resting on the bottleneck of his throat, a knife at his wrists. Others surround him in a circle under a low purple light. Discomfort dripped from his mouth. They were looking for a reaction. The moment was disguised as a get-together, hence the beer, meat, and chapatis, and the women's voices outside rising over music. The third man's arms are crossed as a deep voice enters the discussion and asks him truthfully, Bishop, where are the arms? The night has an Indian heat. Silence glues the third man to his seat. The voice has set a table. He leans into the bishop's ear, rolls his sleeve, and invites him to join him once he has told him where the guns are. The guns. The guns. The bishop replies, I can live without your formality. These courtesies, what meal have you prepared that I have not eaten before? The voice kicks his chair out from under him. Back in the pickup, their bodies are not moving. No side glances. They pass a school, a settlement, a store, a trading post, the hills. But there is no conversation. Notice the bird. The car's headlights are like fireflies. Since the moment has passed, I can tell you, there was no bird. But the men were real, and the table full of food. The only thing missing are the bullets. A second death. That is how nations die over there. And when I say nation, I mean tribe. And when I say tribe, I mean people. And when I say over there, I mean over here.
Thank you, Nick. Your Kitchen family will be down the front of the festival hall on the 21st of September, clapping and cheering for you and Malaika. Every now and then, about every 30 years to date, I have a good idea, and Stablemates was one of them. It brings me so much joy that every month I can bring together three poets like this, and it's just been fantastic. And the first six came for love and for a promise of the split of the door. There was no guarantee of how many people would turn up and how much money they would get. Kai Miller even turned down a trip to Jamaica to keep his promise to me in January. And then somebody else had a good idea, Natalie, who Nick mentioned, who runs the Complete Works programme. She encouraged and helped me to get some Arts Council funding, and so now I can pay the poets and pay expenses to bring an even wider range of poets from outside London. So that's been fantastic. And the Arts Council supports Ledbury Festival as well. So we're so lucky in this country to have an organisation like that. And, you know, despite austerity, they still got some money to give to the arts. I'd really like to thank Chloe and Ledbury Festival for having us. I've been here all week. I've been doing something, presenting or event managing or performing every day. I'm exhausted. But in a good way, it's been fantastic. So, Chloe, I hope you'll have another Stablemates next year. And thanks also to all the people who work and volunteer at the festival, to the fantastic tech team. We've had Greg looking after us tonight, and all the volunteers, including Leslie Ingram, who's the event manager, and all the other event managers tonight. Thank you all for coming. We wouldn't bother if you didn't turn up and listen to us. Thank you.
As a fellow stablemate,